Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, on American Variety, we're partial to adventurers, and I've had many on as guests over the years. Explorers and astronauts and hunters of Spanish treasure and even long-ago downed aviators in the jungles of the South Pacific, and many other adventurers. Well, last week we were talking with Aaron Shetterly, who's a writer, an author, about a very interesting story. It's something that took place in the late 50s and early 60s, relating to an American named William Morgan, who led a very kind of rocky road kind of early life in the States and was in and out of jail and was tied up with the mob to some extent. I mean, he never murdered anybody, but he was just kind of a juvenile delinquent on steroids, so to speak, and kind of failed at everything he did. But he was an idealistic, adventurous person, a smart person, without really any education due to his own fault, came from a very good family. But in 1957, he went down from Miami, where he had been working in the circus and was a fire eater, married to a snake charmer. But he got interested in this burgeoning revolution that he heard about in Cuba and went down to try to support the Cuban Revolution against the then dictator of Cuba named Batista. And so we talked last week about the lead into all of this and what his earlier life was like and how he got involved with this activity in Cuba and the first phase of it, where he went and joined a group that was called the Second Front. It was an allied group of Castro's own forces who were in a different mountain range, and quickly went from being suspected of maybe being a CIA spy or something to being the comandante of this group and a leader of it. You know, he impressed them with his bravery and his military skill, which he had gained in the army during the brief period that he was in the army. And so where we left off last week was that Batista had fled the country and gone to the Dominican Republic, where he kind of holed up with Rafael Trujillo, who was the then dictator of the Dominican Republic. And they had come back to try to overthrow Castro, and Morgan had been instrumental in helping Castro realize that this was coming. And so they met the Dominican troops and basically overthrew that attempt to overturn Castro's revolution. What we have is that basically Castro, with Morgan's help, has won the war, the civil war, to overthrow Batista. Now we're going to get to the part of what went on from there and led to Morgan's downfall pretty quickly. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks, Court.
Yeah, good to have you back on the show. And so let's pick up where we left off, which was, how did things fall apart between Morgan and Castro, since Morgan had been so useful to him up until that point?
So I want to bring in for a second Eloy Gutierrez Manoyo, who was the leader of the Second Front group that you're talking about, that Morgan was basically Morgan's boss in the fight. Manoyo and his family had come from Spain after the Spanish Civil War and were Republicans in what were called in Spain. They had been fighting against fascism. They had deeply held convictions about social democracy, democratic socialism. Morgan was sort of an idealistic but fairly unformed politically, and really became a mentee of the Manoyo family and developed these ideas about democracy and social democracy that he began to hold himself. And they were all against communism. They felt that that was another form of totalitarianism. So in the late 1959 and early 1960, Fidel Castro starts to really consolidate his power and to not kick communists out of the government that he's forming. And this begins to make people like Morgan and Manoyo very uneasy. And then in early 1960, he begins to take over the press. And so the freedom of press begins to go away in Cuba. And this makes Morgan very uncomfortable. And what happens is some of the people that Morgan fought with in the center of the country who were from there began to go back up into the mountains and decide that this was not the government they wanted. And Morgan was suddenly faced with a choice of whether to keep participating in Fidel Castro's government or to join these counter-revolutionaries that had decided that this was not what they had signed up for. So he's in about March of 1960, he's trying to figure out what he's going to do.
Backing up just a little bit, I mean, 1959 was a pivotal year for Morgan. The interesting thing was he had married a young woman that he had met in the Escambray, who was herself a student who had become an activist against Batista, to the extent that the secret police were suddenly after her, and she fled her little village she was in the Escambray Mountains, and came up and joined this group about the time that Morgan did, or a little after Morgan did. And so he met this young woman, and they fell in love. Around this time, because Morgan had foiled the CIA-backed plot by Trujillo and Batista to overthrow Castro, as you say, he had angered J. Edgar Hoover. So Morgan's citizenship was revoked. His U.S. citizenship was revoked, and he lost his passport. He even renounced it publicly on Havana radio. So he had kind of burned his bridges, had no way to get back to the U.S. if he wanted to. So now he's married to a Cuban woman. They had a couple of children. This is all in 1959 and 1960. So we talked about in the other show how Morgan was really interested in democracy in Cuba and in freedom. And the Escambray people were anti-fascist, so by default they were kind of interested in democracy too. But Castro began to turn toward communism, partly with the influence of Che Guevara, who was really a committed Marxist, right, and a very hardline ideological communist. It's funny about Che Guevara, who's kind of the poster child for cool revolutionaries and young idealistic Americans and people from Western countries around the world like him because he looks cool with his long hair and his scraggly beard and the beret, but he really was a merciless little extremist, and he would kill people at the drop of a hat if they didn't agree with him. And so he was a tricky person to deal with, and he had Castro's ear and had a lot of influence with Castro. So Morgan had believed Castro when he promised to set up a capitalist parliamentary democracy, but then Castro began to turn. So what kind of devolved there? I mean, how did that kind of then drive things that happened?
There are a number of things in play, but one of the things that I've always felt about Castro in this moment is that in some ways he's perhaps less interested in ideology than in power. Hmm. And at one point he said, if I have to make a partnership with a superpower, would I rather do it with one 90 miles away or halfway around the world? And there's a bit of pragmatism there on his part in terms of choosing the Soviet Union, which is going to be far away and can help protect them, but isn't going to interfere to the same degree in his day-to-day operations. It becomes pretty clear in early 1960 that some of the people who had hoped to be part of the government weren't going to be part of the government, and that the freedoms that they had fought for weren't going to be honored under Castro's government. You have a lot of discomfort by people worry and people trying to figure out what to do, and more people leaving the country and going to Miami or Venezuela or Spain and deciding that as land was appropriated, as the freedom of the press was ended, as communists were put in positions of power in Cuba, that this was not going to be the place for them. And as you mentioned, Morgan all of a sudden didn't have a lot of options. He couldn't go back to the United States. His citizenship had been revoked. And he had, after the Trujillo affair, a bounty on his head. Trujillo was offering $500,000 for any mercenary who could get to Cuba and kill Morgan. Hmm. So in Cuba, Morgan, at the very least, had a bodyguard and felt that it would be hard for them to get to him. And as I'm sure you're going to talk about, he had a job he liked a lot and was helping the people that he had fought with have jobs, get education, and better their lives. And he felt good about that part, even though he was feeling more and more uncomfortable with Castro and the government.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Aaron Shetterly, who is the author of a book in 2007 called The Americano, about a guy named William Morgan, an American, who went to fight with Fidel Castro's rebel forces against the dictator Batista in Cuba. Yeah, so he started living very dangerously. And this is where his kind of the recklessness we talked about in the previous show comes into play. He didn't give that as much importance as he should have if he intended to save his life, right? So he really wanted, I think, to settle down. At this point, he's married, as I mentioned, and had a couple of children. And he wanted to settle down and have kind of a quiet, happy life in Cuba. So he began frog farming. And he employed about 600 workers and shipped roughly 50,000 pounds of frozen frog legs on average per month to the U.S. So he was very successful in that. By 1960, as we were talking about, he had become disenchanted with Castro. So I think he began working for the CIA, didn't he? He was collecting arms and sending them to rebels in Cuba who were intending then to fight Castro. Is that true?
It is. It's half true in this sense. And one thing, a quick note about the Frog Farm. What's ironic about the job at the Frog Farm is technically he was working for Che Guevara. Because this was part of the Institute of Agrarian Reform. So this was a state-run business that Morgan was running very successfully, that, as you mentioned, was shipping frog legs, belts, purses, wallets out of frog skin, and this sort of thing. But you're right. What happens is he starts, after this moment of choice earlier, a couple months earlier, he decides to start helping these people who've gone back up into the hills to form a new counter-revolutionary group against Castro. And he starts packing guns into barrels and moving them up into the mountains. Now, the part about working for the CIA, that I would push back on just a little bit. I had the adventurous experience of when I was researching this book in Cuba of meeting Philip Agee. And I don't, that name rings a bell, but he wrote a book called a tell-all CIA book that got him in big trouble, called Inside the Company in 1975, and could never live in the United States again. Ended up living and dying in Cuba. I asked Agee about Morgan, and he said, listen, here's something you have to remember. Just because you take help from the CIA doesn't mean you're working for the CIA. There's no question that Morgan received some arms through different channels from the CIA, but I think that he was working more for the people he fought for, and that he wasn't an instrument of the CIA so much as taking resources from them that he thought he could deploy in a just cause.
So one way or another, though, he is beginning to tick Castro off royally.
What he didn't know is that inside his circle of bodyguards, he had an informant, a guy named Cecilio Castro, no relation to Fidel. And Cecilio was starting to tell Fidel what Morgan was doing. And so they were watching, and they knew that he was starting to participate in some of this activity, that he was talking against communism, which they didn't like. And they were watching this begin to happen.
All right. So then we kind of cut to the chase here. Morgan was arrested in October 1960, finally, and he was tried for, I guess, treason and imprisoned and shot on March 11th, 1961. So there's kind of a long, convoluted, and to some extent contested story about all of that. He might have had a chance to escape, but the plan fell through and so on. But anyway, he was executed by the man, by Castro, who he had supported and helped to win just 2 years before, right? And he was shot in 1961. He was arrested in 1960. So there is a story that I heard, and I don't know if this is true. Maybe you can shed some light on it, that as he was about to be executed, he refused a blindfold. He refused to be handcuffed. He was going to stand and take it like a man, and they told him to kneel, and he refused to kneel, and then a voice called out, who might have been Castro watching, to shoot him, shoot his knees, and they shot him in the knees, and he fell to the ground, and then they executed him. Is that true?
There are a number of stories about Morgan's last minutes, and all of them talk about his bravery, and I think that that's the essential piece to hold on to. The story that I ended up making the most sense to me, and I have heard the story you just talked about, but this is not right or wrong. These are, you know, when someone enters myth to some degree, which he did in that moment, there are a lot of different stories that get told.
Sure.
One of the stories that I heard was that actually, because he was a comandante, he was allowed to command the firing squad himself. And so he said to the firing squad, again, right, no blindfold. He said, ask for a cigarette. And they gave him a cigarette. And he smoked the cigarette down. And he said, when I flick the cigarette away, shoot me. And so you can imagine this moment where he finishes his cigarette, he flicks it into the air, and they fire. And that's the end of his adventure.
You know, so that I hadn't heard, and if it's true, it totally fits the image of him as the kind of flamboyant, you know, kind of theatrical person that we've been describing here. I mean, if you see the videos of him, he looks colorful. He's a handsome guy. He's big, and he has kind of a vainglorious look about him. He's kind of pleased with himself. So I'm wondering what drove him. I'm going to read something that he sent to the New York Times during this time, that, as you say, he was becoming famous. And it's strange that he's so little known now, and that's why we're doing this show in part, and that's why you wrote your book. You were the first person to really kind of out him into modern consciousness in recent years. But here's an essay he wrote to a reporter in the New York Times who was kind of beginning to tell his story, Morgan's story. "Why do I fight here in this land so foreign to my own? Why did I come here far from my home and family? Why do I worry about these men here in these mountains with me? Is it because they were all close friends of mine? No. When I came here, they were strangers to me. I could not speak their language or understand their problems. Is it because I seek adventure? No, here there is no adventure, only the ever-existent problems of survival. So why am I here? I'm here because I believe that the most important thing for free men to do is to protect the freedom of others. I'm here so that my son, when he's grown, will not have to fight or die in a land not his own, because one man or group of men try to take his liberty from him. I'm here because I believe that free men should take up arms and stand together and fight and destroy the groups and forces that want to take the rights of people away." I mean, that's... It's kind of a Tom Paine-like declaration. I mean, you know, this guy really ought to be famous, as I said at the beginning of the first show on him. He ought to be more famous than Che Guevara, and yet he's been kind of disappeared. And the reason for that, I think, is that Cuban authorities suppressed the history of his role in the revolution after his downfall because they didn't want him to remain the Robin Hood-like mythical hero that you described, Aaron. And the CIA, on their part, made it all classified because it was the kind of thing they classified, right? And so for those two reasons, he sort of fell into oblivion and only recently has begun to come out of that. But, I mean, I would ask you, was he mainly a thrill seeker or what?
One of the things I write about in my book, and, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and, you know, neither of us can climb into William Morgan's head at this point and figure out really everything that made him tick. But to our earlier conversation, I don't think he ever fit in Northern Ohio. I think he was too boisterous. He was too flamboyant, as you said. He liked to talk with his hands. He liked to tell jokes. And he got to Cuba, Court, and all of a sudden, he was around a lot of people that were like that, that were theatrical, that were loud, that laughed, that spoke with their hands. And all of a sudden, he found a place where he fit in for the first time. And I think that, you know, we're talking about and it's profound what you read, and it's true. But there was also this sort of very emotional, personal level on which he connected with the people around him. And when I was spent all this time in Cuba and Miami doing research for the book, particularly in Miami, but also in Cuba, when people felt safe that I would protect them if they were going to say something positive about him, these people that he fought with loved him. They trusted him. They thought that this was someone that they admired. And so I think seen through that lens, which I think is a really important lens as we try to figure out who he was, I think he really discovered himself in Cuba and was fighting for what he believed in, what he thought was right.
You know, maybe a way I would put it was that he was basically your classic American rebel without a cause who found his cause.
I completely agree. I think that's well put.
So, Aaron, given the scarcity of information we talked about Morgan, when you started, how hard was it to research and write your book?
Well, it's interesting, Court. In a way, Morgan's story was hiding in plain sight. I discovered when I went to the National Archives and Records Administration in Maryland that Morgan's CIA documents, FBI documents, and State Department documents had been pulled into the JFK assassination file, which were public. And I found a huge amount of information on Morgan there. What became harder and trickier was getting personal anecdotes in Cuba and in Miami about Morgan. In Cuba, he was called a traitor CIA agent, and in Miami, a communist. And no one in either place really wanted to talk about him because he was politically and culturally inappropriate in both places. People were nervous I had people walk away from me in Cuba when I wanted to talk about them. I even got kicked out of a little town in the mountains in central Cuba when I was trying to do research. And in Miami, when I was at the University of Miami Library, a librarian walked away from me and said, my husband says he's a communist. So the part made it really tricky at times.
Well, that's really a challenge. So how did you break the ice?
Persistence. I just kept coming back and was able, you know, by talking to as many people as I could, eventually find people who were willing to open up and who felt that the story was important. And what was interesting was a lot of the Second National Front, the Second Front men, left Cuba and lived in Miami now. And when I tapped into them and found them, they were these absolutely wonderful people who were anxious to tell their story because, like Morgan, they had been squeezed between these poles and hadn't felt like their story had ever gotten accredited, sir.
Okay, yeah, I understand. So you finally had to find the people who really weren't biased or prejudiced or twisted in their view of Morgan. You had to find the people who actually knew him and knew the whole story. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Aaron Shetterly about a book he wrote called The Americano, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom. And it's about a very adventurous and interesting American named William Morgan, who helped, as the title implies, Castro win the revolution in Cuba in the late 50s and early 60s. Fascinating story. You know, it's funny, I can think of only one other parallel to him that I'm aware of, kind of an idealistic soldier of fortune like we've been describing. That's a man named Robert Hale Merriman, who was the commander of the Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War. And the Lincoln Brigade, who, for those who may not know it, were Americans and to some extent Canadians, but I think mainly Americans who were young, idealistic, a lot of them college students and young professors, who went to join the, I get confused about the terms here, but went to join the Republican forces who were fighting against the Nationalist forces in a civil war in Spain, the Nationalist forces being led by Generalissimo Franco and backed by fascist Germany and Italy. These were people who were kind of incipiently communist at a time when communism was a thing that idealistic, well-educated young Americans were attracted to before it became known what it really was like. And so they knew they wanted to fight against fascism. So he was one of the people who went there, and he became the commander of the Lincoln Brigade, the Comandante, right? And in fiction, the hero of Hemingway's great novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, is an American guerrilla fighter named Robert Jordan, who many think was modeled after Merriman. And what's funny here is that in marrying Olga, the young woman rebel that we mentioned earlier, he was also like Jordan, who fell in love with a young revolutionary there in Spain named Maria. So there are really these bizarre parallels that I'm sure weren't intentional on his part between William Morgan and Robert Jordan and Robert Hale Merriman in the Spanish Civil War. And there Morgan was in Cuba. So it's a very interesting thing. Well, Aaron, given the uncanny, really, connection between Morgan's story and Hemingway's book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and the core story there. Is there any actual connection between Morgan and Hemingway, who did, in fact, live in Cuba at this time?
So one of the most exciting moments in my early research for this book, Herbert Matthews was a New York Times reporter who played a critical role in getting the story about the Cuban Revolution out to the American public. I was in the Herbert Matthews archives at Columbia University, and I knew that Matthews and Hemingway had both reported from the Spanish Civil War. And I was curious to see if there was any communication between them. And I was going through Matthews' papers, and I came across a letter that he wrote to Hemingway in 1961, about less than 2 months before Hemingway died. And what it basically said was, he recaps Morgan's story to Hemingway. And he says, it sounds like a Hemingway book to me. And he says, by all accounts, he died bravely. And then he said, and he kept believing in freedom long after it became safe to do so in Cuba. So what was interesting was, what was riveting about this moment is, here I was embarking on this journey to write this book, and here was Matthews telling Hemingway, of all people, that he should write the book. And so that was a pretty exciting find. And obviously, Matthews himself had never met Morgan. His wife had. And as far as I know, Hemingway didn't meet Morgan. But the quality of the story resonated deeply with both the men, and they communicated about it.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. Well, it's unfortunate that Hemingway was a shipwreck by that time, and as you say, was about 2 months away from killing himself, so that's too bad. But you did follow up on what would have been possibly Hemingway's choice, so that was great, and glad you did. Again, I just think Morgan's story seems made for a feature film. I mean, this is like a blockbuster story, and it's true, right? So has there been any interest in making a movie about him that you know of?
Court, my book has been optioned since before I wrote it. Mm. And so there's been interest in making a film for, oh, goodness, at this point, what, 15 years. Now there's, as I understand it, there are other projects out there, too, based on David Brand's New Yorker story. And my book is now under development for a TV series. So we'll see what happens. A lot of these, there are a lot of false starts in the movie and TV business, as you know. Yeah. And certainly with this project, there have been many false starts, and nothing is covered yet. But I have my fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, me too. And I hope all of us out there have our fingers crossed for him. I mean, you know, options are funny things. They pay you a relatively small amount of money to tie up your story and buy the rights to it, and then it can sit on the shelf gathering dust for decades, or it can be made, you know, quickly into a movie, or it can sit for a long time and then suddenly take fire, you know, so anything can happen with that. Well, it'll be interesting to follow that and watch the story of William Morgan as it develops, because he is such a charismatic American figure, and so, in a way, so prototypically American. I mean, he was a man of action, as Hemingway used to say, in a time now when almost no one is a man or a woman of action. I mean, maybe there are more women of action than there are men of action nowadays in America. I don't know. But he was a classic case of that, a misfit who went to another country and found his place and did good. But he ended up dying in a blaze of glory, so to speak, executed by the person that he had helped put in power. Well, Aaron, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety again this second time and talking with us about the story of William Morgan.
Thank you, Court. It's been great to be with you.
Aaron is a writer and editor, and he's on the board of the art and education organization Americans Who Tell the Truth. He conceived and organized and ran an exchange between artists from Maine and Cuba for an organization called the Union of Maine Visual Artists. Aaron Shetterly is currently a fellow at the Virginia Humanities, working on a book about the Greensboro Massacre of 1979. I had not heard of it, so all of you out there might want to look that up. But Aaron's book, again, that we've been talking about is The Americano, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom, and it's available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the usual outlets. If you'd like to watch the American Experience episode that describes this visually in great detail and has a lot of video of Morgan in his early years and so on, and during the Cuba period, you can still watch that episode. Go to pbs.org, click on American Experience, there's a tab there, American Experience, and then search for, you can type this in the search box, American Commandante, and you'll find the whole hour-long episode. It's very interesting. Thanks again, Aaron, and I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.